Enrique, I appreciate that call, and I hope that you know, the new home you moved into, you know, he's in good health and joy and all the positive vibes and all that for you. Congratulations.
Oh, that means a lot. Really appreciate it. You guys have a great weekend.
No problem.
Yeah, you
Thank
too.
You too. Oh,
all right, we are
all this positivity. I really appreciate it. I'm gonna figure out something neighborly to do, and I'm gonna do it for my neighbors.
Yeah, I dig that. I'm gonna brainstorm. Maybe we'll come back at you next week with some ideas. We are running up on the hour here. You've been listening to The Gap. I'm Althea, my better half, Tammy. Thank you, Sonia, in the studio. We've been talking about community, social capital, talking to people about tough topics. And one last reminder before we go, if you are interested in supporting KBOO community, I'm underlining that with my voice radio, you can go to kboo.fm and click on that good old donate button and help support your community connection.
See ya.
Bye.
Power of community radio? Then show your support by donating to KBOO today. We have a fundraising goal of $80,000, and we need listeners like you to help us get there. Show your support for non-commercial, people-powered community radio by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the donate button to become a member.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that takes our history out of the oldest and largest collection of public radio programming in the United States and puts it back on the radio. When people think of the documentary film work today, the name that often pops up is the king of PBS documentaries, Ken Burns. His storytelling style uses images, historic letters, music, and poignant narration and voiceovers. But before Burns gave us the Civil War, jazz, baseball, and many others, two brothers, Albert and David Maisels, made history selectively choosing unconventional subject matter for their documentary films. They include 1968's Salesman, which follows the road travels of a Bible salesman, and Gimme Shelter, the iconic 1970 film chronicling the infamous Rolling Stones 1969 performance in Altamont, California, where the Hell's Angels were hired as security and ended the summer of love in an evening of violence and death.
And we talked about the imagery part, and Mick had a lot of feelings about this and about all our false heroes on motorcycles. From all the ones that we've worshipped all these years, you know, Brando's and the Deans and all the people that we made it all happen, you know, now you have it.
On this week on From the Vault, we found two outstanding programs in the archives where we get to hear from each of the Maisel brothers. From 1971, we have an interview with the younger brother, David, who is happy to talk about his experience with Mick Jagger, Brian Jones, Keith Richards, and the rest of the Rolling Stones before and after that fateful day in Altamont. And from 1976, we hear from older brother Albert Maisel, who spoke about his experience shooting the now cult film classic Grey Gardens, now on the National Film Registry at the Library of Congress. I'm personally a big fan of this film and the subsequent artistic adaptations. It's about Edith Ewing Bouvier Beale and her daughter Edith Bouvier Beale, the aunt and cousin of former First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, better known as Big Edie and Little Edie.
Well, David and Al seem worried.
They are now.
They have worked so hard, and I think they think that the film is not appreciated or something. I'm very worried about both of them. I think it will be appreciated.
Yeah. Do you have
Remember
any...
what you said? Be it... patient.
The two women, former socialites, lived in a decaying mansion called Grey Gardens for decades and in increasing squalor and isolation. Their Grey Gardens film inspired the 2006 Tony Award-winning Broadway musical of the same name with Christine Ebersole and Mary Louise Wilson, and the 2010 Emmy and Golden Globe Award-winning HBO film starring Drew Barrymore and Jessica Lange as the Beals. A little bit about the Maisels. Albert was born in 1926 in Boston, Massachusetts. He received a master's degree from Boston University and taught psychology before he turned to filmmaking. David was also born in Boston, but in 1932. He teamed up with his brother Albert to produce a film about the first Beatles tour in 1964. This began a partnership in filmmaking until David died of a stroke in 1987. Together, they produced 20 films, and in 2005, Albert established the Maisels Institute to help underprivileged students learn the craft of filmmaking. We begin with Pacifica Station WBAI in New York producer Joseph Gelmis as he interviews David Maisels and writer Richard Gelstein from 1971.
This is Joseph Gelmis, film critic for Newsday. The program is The Movies. We're doing a special today, the title of which is Gimme Shelter, a document of the Stones at Altamont. With me to speak about the film is that one of the co-directors, David Maisels, and writer Richard Goldstein. The film is a record of the Rolling Stones concert tour in America in 1969, which culminated on December 6th, I think it was, 1969, at the Altamont Speedway in Livermore, California, in a free concert that Rolling Stones gave, at which a number of unpleasant things happened in addition to free music, including one young man, Meredith Hunter, being stabbed and killed within view of the stage, allegedly by Hell's Angels. And this, along with the frenzy of the crowd, the rapport of the crowd, the lifestyle and singing style of the Rolling Stones, was all captured in this reality document, Gimme Shelter. I'd like to start approaching this program to talk about first the film as a film. Why you, David, and your brother Albert, and Charlotte Zwerin, who are all the co-directors together, got involved with this film. I know the last one you made that we've seen is Salesman.
Right.
And I remember you were going to make a film about your mother. And then suddenly I hear that you're into a whole film about rock superstars.
Yeah, rock and roll is here to stay. I take exception with one phrase that you use that other people are using, and that is a filmed record of a tour. Never thought of it as of any of our work ever representing a recording or just recording. And I guess there's more than one meaning to that. When recording sound or recording film or recording events, we're not doing that at all. It's not the truth and nothing but the truth. And it's not a thesis. It's not a television type of reporting that's trying to give you all sides of the story. It's our impression, our truth.
We find out first why you did it and how you happened to get involved with him.
Why we did it? Well, there's been an awful lot of inaccurate information about this too. Maybe this will help us see if I can get it down exactly how it happened. We heard from a friend of ours in California that the Stones wanted to get in touch with us about filming some material at Madison Square Garden. This was a day before Madison Square Garden. We had heard about the tour and everything, and I myself are a great Stones fan. We said to ourselves, "Well, sure, we'd love to do it. What do they want to do?" So we've got in touch with them. Our friend was Haskell Wexler, who was also a filmmaker.
Medium cool.
Right. He said, they want you to get in touch with him and call Ronnie Schneider at the Plaza Hotel. So we called him, we went up and to see him. Stones had just arrived in the city. Went up to his room at the Plaza, and he said, well, we'd really like you to film some stuff. Mick would like you to film some stuff of Madison Square Garden. Of course, you should get together with Mick and talk to him about it. And of our, the Stones are going to be performing there tomorrow, mm-hmm. and the next day there'll be two more performances. He'd like you to get it, your impression of it. Doesn't want to tell you how to do it. just film the concerts and try to get something of B.B. King and Ike and Tina Turner, because maybe we can use the material later on in something else. And I know that they were planning to, and then I learned that they were planning to go to Russia, which I thought would be really interesting, and they're going on a world tour, and what have you.
So there was no thought at that time to the final, what the final form would be at that
moment. Right. We'll do that. Yeah. And we did it for a fee for those 3 days. Meanwhile, we got to talking to Jagger a bit and to liking him very, very much. First time, first meeting. And to just having a lot of rapport with Mick and with Keith. And we were talking about how we could make a film together. Not even thinking of Madison Square Garden, really. Mm-hmm. But just how we, you know, make a film together. So we said, well, we'll talk about it. We'll travel a little with you because you're going to be moving. Maybe we'll bring our cameras, maybe we won't. We did go up to Boston the next day, and we talked about more about this film that we thought we'd do together. We were talking about fiction and about real-life situations and some of the films that we had done. Brian Jones happened to know a lot about the films that we've done, and
had
he
liked
them a great deal, and
had
recommended
us. Had he made Performance or Ned Kelly by this time?
Oh, yeah, a long time before. This is all back in...
This is 69, right?
Right, just before
the winter, yeah.
Right, only, you know, 10 days before Baltimore. So we went to Boston, which is our hometown, and we thought we'd go up there and visit, too, while we were up there. And we went up on the plane with Jagger and Richards and kept on talking about these things as much time as we had, but we never really came to anything. We found ourselves filming all the way to California.
At whose expense was that?
At our expense. They paid us for the initial thing at Madison Square Garden, and then we went along on our own expense. Until a point after Altamont, I'm getting ahead now, a point after Altamont when they said, we really have a film now, we have this fantastic material, we want to put together a feature film, and can you help us with some money? Because we'll do it together. And we got some money from them, what amounted to, in the very end, less than a third of the cost of the film. So we essentially financed it.
Well, the film cost about $100,000?
$500,000.
You were fairly close for a long time, still are. You were writing about rock music and rock culture and so on. Did you ever foresee just that in fact an Altamont could happen, where somehow there was an alliance, a coalition somehow between overt violence and a violence cult with those who were in fact singing about it as idols like the Rolling Stones are?
I had a lot of... I mean, I like the violence of rock. I always have liked the violence of rock. And then again, I've seen so much violence in terms of my own assignments in journalism, which had nothing to do with rock music, that it's really hard for me to say that one caused the other, or that there was a real causal relationship between the music and the murder that took place there. Mm-hmm. It just seemed to me to be another example of what in my own Eastern chauvinism I call California madness. You know,
you repudiate it as a universal experience, but just something peculiar to California.
That was my impression. You know, having to do with maybe certain right of mobility that people out there seem to feel they have. A right of space. People seem to think they have the right to have a lot of space around them, and getting incredibly uptight when they're crowded together.
It was interesting what you said before, when you asked about is that the meaning of Altamont? And Richard said, no, it's just a feeling. This is so... we're obviously very, very aware of everything about Altamont now, much more than we ever were when we were there or when we were making the film, because everybody's writing about it. Mm-hmm. And all these opinions on the significance and the meaning of Altamont, everybody's trying to write it. Well, not very few people are saying what they feel about it. Because what you feel, maybe that's the meaning. Mm-hmm. And do you have to find the word like a generation gap or some other kind of cliche to describe it? The end of innocence, the this, the that. It's, you know, I know how I felt when I left it.
How do you feel?
How I felt when I was there toward the end of it and when I left it. Well, really shook up, very, very afraid, very... I'll tell you, I had this weird feeling of somehow I live in an awfully safe world. It's what you were talking about a few minutes ago, about not confronting any other kind of people, you know, when you're off in California, in some place. Well, even in New York, my God, we don't, people are supposed to, that have addresses that we know, that we meet and find out that they've been living only, you know, this happens to me all the time, living three blocks away, and they've been living, you know, for 5 years and I've never seen them.
You are listening to the filmmakers The Maisel Brothers on From the Vault, featuring interviews about Gimme Shelter and Grey Gardens. For more information about this program or other programs in our archive, give us a call at 1-800-735-0230 or visit us online at fromthevaultradio.org. You can always search our entire collection at pacificaradioarchives.org. And now back to the program.
Sonny Barger was quoted as saying, ain't nobody going to kick my motorcycle. Yeah. And then someone commented about that, you know, like this is the purest expression of American or Western civilization's greed, property consciousness that you can find, that they go out with leaded Q-sticks to protect the bikes, which have been pushed and dented a little bit by people crushing in on it who wanted to see the Rolling Stones close up. Mm. And then you say that they protected that truck and the roof didn't cave in. Well, that's like saying, you know, you have police and police do a pretty good job, but sometimes they use overkill.
Is they weren't, their presence, they didn't, they were very, very nice to the people that tried to get on top of it. Mm-hmm. They didn't, they conducted themselves very well, and not like policemen, these particular four guys. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know whether it's the nature of a Hell's Angel that, you know, that they completely do a switch around at some time or another, but at least for the time that I was there, these guys were very, very nice, and they probably saved my life.
At what point?
I mean, well, at least saved me from getting beat up or something.
By their fellows?
Well, they were, or by anybody. I mean, every minute you were there, you thought someone was going to hit you.
Somebody,
or a beer can would land on you.
Somebody, in fact, punched out Mick Jagger when he was coming out of his
right.
trailer, didn't they rush up to him at
no,
one point?
No, when he
point?
Came off the helicopter and came into the...
And you show that when somebody right. yells, "I hate you," and,
right.
and hits him in the face.
Right. Right.
What kind of? I mean,
when
we talk
Marty
about.
Ballin got
well, wasn't that by one of the Hell's Angels that he jumped off the stage to help somebody in the middle of a performance by the Jefferson Airplane, and
well,
he got knocked unconscious?
We don't see. We see him jumping off the stage and everything, but I didn't see. I've heard so many versions. I've heard the Hell's Angels version of it. I've heard Marty's version of it. I've heard five other versions of it.
Mm-hmm.
So-called eyewitnesses. This is the trouble with this whole thing too. Who hired the Hell's Angels? Were they hired at all? You know, $500 worth of beer. Can you hire a Hell's Angel? Will he be hired? I mean, all these questions. You know, it's really, it's impossible to really find out an answer that really convinces me of the truth. You know?
Well, the thing that occurred to everybody, I imagine, or people there I've heard from, is the helplessness of all the people in the presence of... I don't know how many angels there were,
right.
but there were you know, hundreds of thousands of people held at bay by those people. And that perhaps is one of the most frightening things about the event, I suppose. And that was one of the reasons why I also felt I wanted to separate myself from all those people.
Because it was so passive and allowed things to happen around them?
Well, it frightened me, yeah.
Because there were pictures of them, incredible. I think the audience, of course, always in a Rolling Stones concert is half the performance in a way for me, but... that the audience in this case watching the performance and only giving half their attention to things 3 or 4 feet away where people are on the ground and
yeah.
surrounded by Hell's Angels with upraised sticks and being beaten and not making a move either to go away or else to help.
Well, you see this in a lot of situations that involve violence, the fact that people are immobilized by violence.
Maybe they were stoned.
It's also not
that. No, it's not only that. It's also, that has a lot. I saw that in Chicago. I saw people frozen dead sort of in the middle of streets with policemen coming at them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's one of the ways that people react to violence is to stand very still and just disappear from the situation.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is a fact that, I don't know if it was the drugs or if it was the occasion of it being a rock and roll concert or if it was something else involved, but... I got the unavoidable impression that these people had better learn how to defend themselves, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that they were being stomped on, you know. And,
but they're not organized. They're en masse, but they're all individuals. In this case, they never really apparently did come together, whereas the Hell's Angels travel as a very organized swarm.
Yeah.
And it is very difficult to defend yourself against chains and cue sticks when, in fact, you're an individual, even if you're there in a casual relationship with somebody else instead of a blood brother like that.
Yeah. I wonder how many of them were provoked, how many of those situations. I only saw that one incident that we have in the film. Actually, in the film, there, you know, in terms of seconds, there aren't that many seconds of violence. I think altogether, on frame by frame, there couldn't be more than 5 or 10 seconds of violence. Of course, within those 10 seconds is a murder, and then you see some cue sticks. Now, those are two incidents.
But Lee Harvey Oswald being shot in a movie.
Well, that's exactly what I'm thinking about.
10 seconds would be the key.
That's another incident. Was that symptomatic of the whole nation? I don't know. Those individual acts. Are these individual acts in one particular place, and everybody's calling Altamont the end of the world? You know.
Well, don't you have any feelings?
Those are two things, and I wonder how much the Hells Angels were they ever provoked? Were there kids that were making wise-ass remarks at them and their bikes?
But
were there people that try to provoke them? Wait a minute.
Wow.
It takes two to make every fight one. Now, at the same time, I want to say that it's more than likely that Hell's Angels love being provoked and love a fight. I mean, they are made, you know, their whole thing is violence. It doesn't absolve the some of the kids that were really freaked out in drugs. And as Sonny Badger said, and I believe it, that they're running off the hills yelling all kinds of things, probably calling them pigs. Mm-hmm. And looking down upon them, and again, it might not be. They're probably the easiest people in the world to provoke, and they're probably rather paranoid about it, because they have been, shot at.
Like Quantrill's Raiders. I mean,
right.
How do you provoke Quantrill's Raiders? You know, by being in the bank at the time they want to rob it. I would wonder about whether or not there is a defense to be made for. Yeah. People who have deliberately hyped themselves up and are ready for violence at any moment.
Okay, well, let's take the incident itself. A black guy has a gun, right?
Which
came first? I don't know. I've been thinking.
They were looking for each other, right? I mean, in
a black
effect,
guy waved
all their
a gun,
lives,
and a Hell's Angel waved
a knife.
No, we don't know. Though the film implies that the gun came first, we don't really know that.
That was. Right, right. How did you show it in the film again?
Look at that again, audience. Actually.
You showed it in regular action, then slow motion.
Yes.
Or freeze frames, actually.
No, first it goes through in regular speed, just the way it happened.
Yeah.
Which we didn't see the first time. You know, we didn't know anything about this murder until we got into the editing of it, until we saw the material and came back from the laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it. It turned out, because I saw that opening, and mm-hmm. I saw a guy in a green suit waving something mm-hmm. and sort of dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw the same thing in the rushes, but this time we saw a knife. Which
and
never
the way you showed it was before. To show it in silhouette against someone else's clothes, so you can actually see it close up, as I recall. A girl in white dress.
Well, yeah,
was that with a gun?
Actually, there's only 4 frames. There's 24 frames in a second, and only 4 frames of that gun on her.
You certainly noticed
on
that.
Her dress. Yeah, well, because we stop it there.
You're showing it to Mick Jagger on the Moviola, as I recall,
and pointing it out to him.
Well, no, not a Moviola.
What was the purpose of the Moviola device, as far as a device in the film goes? Because that was the one part where I felt some sense of it being artificial.
All right, I think I can explain that. Yeah. First place, it's a machine that we rather love, and it's something rather new. We've had it for about 3 or 4 years now, but it really makes editing a lot easier, and it's a pleasure to work with. It's one of these Steenbeck editing consoles. Have you seen them?
Yeah.
And they have new ones now that have 3 and 4 screens. Mm-hmm. So fantastic when you're filming a concert. You know, when you have so many different views of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Why we use the Steenbeck as a thing.
And showing it to Mick and Keith, as I recall.
Yeah, right. Well, it's interesting. It was Charlotte, who was the co-director on the film, Charlotte Swearin, thought of that as a way of a structure for the film. And I was against it in the beginning, because first place it was sort of, I don't like getting into, no matter how terrific the equipment is, and getting into sort of filmic cliches, you know. Something turns me off about the machinery of it, mm-hmm. and seeing it's too pat or something wrong with it. I don't know. Just didn't hit me. It sort of irritated me as having to use that kind of a device in a film. Until we were really felt that at one point we sort of needed the Stones or Mick's feelings about what happened. Because we weren't really close to them filmically, in any other film material that we had, and we wanted to be more intimate with them. And when we were in England, and we were over there to do some shooting, thought about it, and Mick said, you know, by the way, I'd love to see all the material that you have. So I thought to myself, well, you know, I've been involved with a number of subjects who, after the film is, you know, finished, they want to see every little thing, and they never, you know, have the time or make the effort to really mm-hmm. do that, and I'm not really interested in them doing that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't really want them to see it, but in this case, I said, well, fine, you know, maybe you'll find it interesting and you'll see it. He said, yeah, I'd really like to see everything. When can we start? And so forth. Well, as it turned out, he never really wanted to. But the one time he did, I said, you know, I thought to myself, well, if he really wants to see it, that would be great, because then we could use this thing that Charlotte was talking about, him watching the film. Maybe we get some very, very interesting reactions mm-hmm. of him personally. So it would make the film a lot more personal. And
was that
we actually, I called him, you know, I took the initiative and said, yeah. Well, if you'd really like to see it, we'd like to show it to you, and we'd like to film it too.
Mm-hmm.
So we showed him.
Did you actually show him the sequence that we see he is reacting
right,
to
right,
it?
Right, yeah. Right. So we showed him a lot of stuff, and we filmed him, and that became the device.
Did he say anything that we don't see on screen? Did he say anything that was cut out? Right, the police were interested in seeing this, and you filmed their reaction, right?
Filmed
that's
their
not
reaction.
In the movie.
That
now.
Was the ending at one point.
Yeah.
But then we decided we had to get even closer to the stones, and why take anything away from them?
Well, there's also a murder case involved too, isn't there? There was a murder charge brought against someone, and
it's going to be a trial in California.
Right, and wasn't that therefore their reaction? Anything they said in some way relevant to the murder case? Wouldn't that have made it difficult for you to show it in the film?
That was the problem. That was one of the problems. But as I said, we wanted to use the stones because it keeps it more cohesive somehow, and also there was a reason we couldn't. As it turned out, as the months went on. And the trial kept on being postponed. We couldn't get the releases until after the trial.
Yeah.
So the trial doesn't start until, I think it's going to be postponed
this month?
Again until January. So we never could get their releases because they can't talk.
Right. There's been some talk, too, and I think I asked you this once before the show, when we were just chatting, about the how the police happened to get a piece of the film. It's been inferred by some people that you volunteered it or whatever for the grand jury that handed down an indictment. There was eyewitness and there was a testimony. There was also this chunk of film.
I never did have to face the question whether I should. It's a difficult question.
Was it subpoenaed?
Whether one should bring it to them. We did sort of face the question, but we didn't have to finally really face it because we were subpoenaed.
I see.
Right. So it got us out of phase. It's a difficult.
Did Mick say anything, by the way?
I don't really know how
about what he saw on that screen about the murder, since he obviously didn't see the murder himself when he was on stage. It was too much happening. Did he ever comment when he saw this on the editing machine, other than what we see in the film now? Has he ever verbalized in any way what he
felt about the murder itself?
About the murder and about that experience. Has he verbalized either in film, which you haven't shown us, or else into you?
Yeah, he goes on a little more than that. He was wondering whether he was coming toward the stage or not.
Mm-hmm.
And we went into a sort of a discussion about that, and we finally sort of decided that he wasn't. I didn't want to get into that whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps we shouldn't ignore the fact that the film contains probably the best footage of a rock and roll performance that I can remember anyway. Certainly gives you a new perspective on Jagger's art at the beginning of the film. Just in terms of watching him prance is itself a whole other movie.
That's true.
Not to mention the scene with Tina Turner and his comment about it being good to have a chick once in a while. I got the feeling he should have said a real chick or something like that.
It's just beautiful.
Yeah. The expression on his face when he says that is really something.
Yeah.
I mean, it's real tongue-in-cheek. Yeah. I mean, so many people are so uptight about him and think, you know, because they think he's a fag.
They think he's androgynous, right?
And he isn't at all. He's not afraid of... exhibiting his femininity, which just most Americans, I guess, you know, repress quite a bit.
Well, I hate to bring him up, but Canby used the word omnisexual, and
omni.
Yeah, omnisexual, and it's a you know, legitimate way for an artist to be, and he is.
Yeah.
As far as
radiates
what he projects,
in all degrees, in all directions.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Yeah. It radiates to guys and girls. I think you know.
Fantastic. What more can we want? That's better than male or female, isn't it?
Speaking of radiating, I wonder, did he comment at all? Was he scared about the look on one of the Hell's Angels' faces who was looking at him with this on the stage. It was the most frightening look on a man's face. I thought the man was either insane or moving toward a kind of an outrageous act. I thought something was going to happen, and he was looking at Jagger while Jagger was performing.
Well,
if he summons that kind of emotions out of someone, that's frightening.
He certainly was afraid, but he's also, as he told me one time, that when he's on the stage, it's in another world. I mean, if you're either going to perform or not going to perform, I mean, you can't do it halfway. So when you get into...
such a powerful dance he does. It's really fantastic.
When you get into singing and dancing, you do it. Well, and you can't think about anything else, or you can't do it. I mean, any more than you can hold a camera and have your mind on a whole other thing.
But there are people who do. The Jefferson Airplane, it was either Grace Slick or somebody with them, comments to the angels, either you stop that or we're going to leave. And then finally, Marty Balin gets knocked out. At the beginning of the Stones performance, there is something that happens where Keith says to the angels, either you guys stop that or we're going to leave. And to his credit, because so far as I'm concerned, because Mick never says that. He says something vague about, let's all love each other now, fellas. Let's all be good.
Oh, I thought his speech was inspiring.
You are listening to the filmmakers The Maisel Brothers on From the Vault, featuring interviews about Gimme Shelter and Grey Gardens. For more information about this program or other programs in our archive, give us a call at 1-800-735-0230 or visit us online at fromthevaultradio.org. You can always search our entire collection at pacificaradioarchives.org. And now back to the program.
How do you see Jagger? I'm really curious.
Well, not being one of those, for example, who has read a great deal, I haven't read the Rolling Stones biography.
Oh, well, forget that, but you've seen him.
I've seen him, and therefore I come purely as someone who is a journalist, say, and who is trained to look at little details. And I, without having to read anything into it, the first thought that occurred to me was it was a classic metaphoric situation. I almost compared it to the scene in Fantasia where Mickey Mouse puts on the sorcerer's hat and he plays sorcerer for a day. And he summons up all of these powers with the help of a few litany kind of things. He summons up all with magical powers which he really shouldn't be using because they're bigger than he has the power to control. And then suddenly they get out of hand and he's literally almost overcome and overwhelmed, drowned by them, because he is unequal to the demons he has summoned. And these people around him were the real violence to me. And instead, all he has been a dilettante in the sense that he obviously is not a really violent person. I'll bet he's never beaten up anyone. He has never used it as a way of life. And yet he sings about it all the time very effectively. And I somehow saw this separation between rhetoric, which he represents, the middle-class kid of America and Britain's rhetoric about we got to break loose, we got to have the revolution. And suddenly the guys who are really being absolutely free and don't care about consequences, they're there with him on the same stage, and he is absolutely unequal to the task of in some way coping with them. And that's where my head was at, and I said, my God, this is the Mick Jagger. You know.
Well, you know, this one guy that's supposed to be on this program, right? Michael Lydon? Yeah.
Yes.
And I think you have his piece here. That
yes, that was excerpted
that
from Ramparts. Yeah.
He answers that, and I think we answer that in part, and that is that... Well, I don't know if we don't give you any answers, but I think maybe you can see it in the film. But when Mick talks about what can a poor boy do but fight, but sing in a rock and roll band, mm-hmm. you know, and the time is right for violent revolution.
Palace revolution.
Palace
Very
revolution.
Important.
Okay. He could sing it the next night, violent revolution too.
I don't know because
he changes the lyrics quite a bit.
Yeah, but
not that one.
You're ignoring his sense of irony. His lyrics are very ironic. I went down to the demonstration to get my fair share of abuse. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a tremendous amount of irony and self-observation of his own role. Mm-hmm. This is something that the most the best rock stars really have, especially people like Townsend, who is also another guy who tries to evoke violent feelings and arousal in his audiences.
Why evoke violent feelings in the audience if, when you suddenly are confronted with it, you're down on it, and say you're not in some way committed to it?
Well, I don't know. I always think of him as equal to the task myself.
Well,
as an apprentice. I think of him as a sorcerer.
But here he was with these people, and he wasn't equal to the task. He could have been smashed into small pieces because
he was
so fragile.
What was he wearing that night? What was he wearing?
His own shirt?
No. The Night of Altamont.
He always wears a long scarf.
No, wait a minute. What was he wearing
pants.
The Night of Altamont? He was dressed as the fool.
The black, wasn't he wearing all black?
He was dressed as the fool, the court jester.
I don't know if that
half
was
black,
or not.
Half red.
Well, he does that. He does the strange combination of colors, or attractive combination of colors.
I don't know whether or not I would think that
his irony extended that far.
Oh.
See, I'm willing to defend him on the level of being more articulate and more of an artist than anybody else who is talking the language he's talking.
I think of it in terms of the idea that an artist should be exploring new modes of being. I mean, that's pretty much, I mean, is how I see the job of an artist today, mm-hmm. in this particular time. Mm-hmm. And I look at his performances as sort of liberation rituals. I don't mean to, you know, I don't mean to be rhetorical here, because obviously Mick Jagger can't liberate you. Mm-hmm. But just in terms of a ritual, a mass, I mean, I kind of think of that's what he's about, and I look upon him as some sort of representation of that process. And there's nothing perfect and nothing definitive and nothing predictable about what he does. And I don't blame him for what goes on in the audience or what goes on as a result of it. He's just an explorer, an adventurer. And as far as I'm concerned, what he does with his body is a very articulate
thing. Look, if the explorer or adventurer or wagon train leader leads the whole wagon train over a cliff and everybody goes down 3,000 feet, it's good to say, you know, like he had the right to do it. But I suspect it's at that point we observe as journalists and say, hey, you know, there is in fact something very mindless about where it finally leads. I'm not saying that we've got to use moderation, we can't use liberation.
You don't blame the shaman if the tribe goes to war. It's just, you don't ever know what the result of that process is, and you can never know it, and you just have to live with whatever the consequences are, and you have to undertake it.
Who has to live with the consequences?
I think people in general do, and the artist has to, and the audience has to. That's the risk. Otherwise, if there's no risk in that process, then it's not real. It's just an entertainment, and nobody can claim that rock and roll is an entertainment, ultimately. Because there is always that element of uncertainty.
Look, there is
the
bacchanal quality of, and the Dionysian quality of, which has existed for several thousand years of recorded history, which he is part of, which is to drive somebody into a frenzy by.
No,
a,
I don't think
a,
that's true.
You don't think that's part of this thing at all?
No, I
think that's part of the nature of the charismatic quality that he has.
He never drove me into a frenzy, but I certainly feel a power. I feel his power, and I feel my power when I see him. And I sing, and that's my point of contact with him.
Mm-hmm.
And my respect for him as an artist makes me feel my power.
Which
and
power?
My danger.
You know, like, here's this a process
erotic
by
power?
Which I am learning something now, because I don't fully find that he does this for me. I find physically myself exhilarated, but I can be that way, you know, by any number of means, possibly.
I don't exactly know. It's an erotic kind of power. It's not a power to hurt people. I don't feel, doesn't make me feel sadistic. It makes me feel erotic. Makes me feel aroused, makes me feel like if I had the guts, maybe I could move my body like that, and I would love to do it in front of thousands of people.
Isn't it ironic, since he has a sense of irony you talk about, that, and this is possibly what makes this particular film so powerful, and that event so memorable, for whatever it means, that instead of singing a ballad, or instead of singing something that was sort of lyrical or less provocative, that the song he was singing at the time, as I recall, it wasn't Street Fighting Man, it was
It wasn't Sympathy for the Devil, which every magazine said.
Well, which song was it?
It happened to be Under My Thumb.
Right.
But at that point, it was part of a medley of things he was singing while people were being smashed over the head.
No,
while the violence was coming out.
Medley.
No,
it was just...
He wasn't singing Sympathy for the Devil at any point?
No, he was saying Sympathy for the Devil before he sang Under My Thumb. And the incident... The murder,
but the angels were hitting
occurred
people, even when
at
the
end of Under
on,
My
though.
Thumb.
The angels were smashing out even when the Jefferson airplane, but it became even more, as I recall, I haven't seen a film now for about a week, but as I recall, the film was
a distillation, you know, of a concert. There's 15 songs in every concert, and we only show two of them in Altamont.
Right.
And 15 songs take about a little over an hour to sing, to play.
Would you like to comment on what Richard was talking about your
about
feelings
Mick.
about Mick, and about what, because I think that's why people have made a lot about that concert and about that particular
listen, he's a great artist. I love his work. I like him a great deal, and Keith and the rest of the guys very, very much. They're all very, very good artists, and they're good artists because they can really express their own feelings so beautifully, and that's what they're doing in their music. And if some of those feelings are about violence, and it stirs a lot of people up, who are probably the ones that come are the ones that are asking, like Michael says in this piece we referred to before, they're demanding, you know, give us the answer. Well, Dylan's not giving them the answer, and nor is Jagger. They're telling how they feel about it, and the time is right for palace revolution. Or whatever they're saying, that's what they feel. And they're not saying go out and do it. They're not saying that's the answer. That's going to be the, you know, you'll have a utopia if you follow what I feel when they sing. That's a very, very personal statement. A very, and it, like all the art that I admire most It's extremely autobiographical. I was born in a crossfire hurricane.
I doubt that. He's maybe born in a cross draft at most.
Wait a minute.
But it certainly evokes.
In his own life, he was. And in his way, with a strap across his back, his father was a gym teacher. Please allow me to introduce myself. He considers himself sort of a man of wealth and taste, or he'd like to be.
He is, I'm sure.
He's a great, he has great taste in everything he does. I mean, in everything, no matter what it is. I mean, in writing and in living, and he's a great person to talk to.
How much editing power, or what kind of release did he sign for you that gave you total freedom? Let me ask it this way. What were the bounds of his editorial judgment in this film?
It was never a question. We had editorial control from the beginning of the film. I'll tell you where we shared it with Mick, and we shared it because we wanted to share it with him, and not because there was any ultimatum. But Mick felt very, very strongly about the end of the film, and he really didn't want to tell us what to do with it. But he said, I just can't leave him like that. He got up. We had an ending where he got up from the editing machine, and we froze on him looking out, which had a number of interpretations, like him saying it almost. The picture says maybe what is the answer, or I don't know. It was a very, very powerful ending and left people really shook up, and he felt that you just can't leave him that way. You have to leave him with something. And he didn't say up or down or whatever, but you just can't leave him that way. I guess I'm sure he felt that you can't leave him so down. You have to give him something. Well, after talking about it and talking to Charlotte and to Al and to thinking about it an awful long time and spending about 5 weeks in London and talking to Mick about it and how we could do it and so forth, and came up with the idea of Gimme Shelter as the sort of the message, if you will, or the way to leave the audience. And we had to find the image for that. And we talked about the imagery for it. And Mick had a lot of feelings about this and about all our false heroes on motorcycles, from all the ones that we've worshipped all these years, the Brandos and the Deans and all the people that we made it all happen, now you have it. I mean, all kinds of ideas we talked about, virility, and so many things, but in the end, we just went back to this, and we make all our films from the material that we have, and in our own way. So we carried out his idea with Gimme Shelter, which is the theme of the film anyway.
And the
if you know
ends,
the lyrics.
Yeah.
And the film ends with Gimme Shelter. So that's what we leave him with, and that's the, if
is
you
want
to call it a concession, although I don't think so, because I have a lot of respect for the Stones, and I thought we could carry out that wish for them. Mm-hmm. It's their statement. In fact, we imply that it's his statement at the end. Mm-hmm. It is his statement. It's a very strong statement. Give me shelter.
Except it turns out that his alliance with the outlaw aspect of it, that is to say the Hell's Angels, and you can't say, look, if he didn't want them there, he shouldn't have had them there, so far as I'm concerned. I don't know how the foul-up happened, but there was an alliance which... When he's singing about it is one thing, and suddenly when you see it, I find it doesn't compute. It no longer makes any sense, and I fault him for that, for in some way being involved with something which is beyond his control. Maybe he should have known better. Maybe now he will know better. I don't know.
Well, if you were there, you wouldn't think that it's. If you were at Altamont, you wouldn't think that's Mick Jagger's fault. He brought us here,
It's like Abbie Hoffman bringing us to Chicago. It doesn't work really.
I think that he's also a prisoner. Like I was pointing out, like Tolstoy says at the end of War and Peace, when he's talking about, is Napoleon caused by the times, or is he caused the times, and so on. It's both, but it's mostly, like you're as much an onlooker at your life as he was in that editing machine, as the one who was the cause.
What's the expression today? Part of the problem, or part of the solution,
yeah.
Right?
The program has been special. Gimme Shelter, a document of the Stones at Altamont. It's based on the new Maisels brothers, and it's David Maisels and Albert Maisels, plus Charlotte Zwerin as their co-director, film Gimme Shelter. And my guest has been David Maisels and writer Richard Goldstein.
And now we hear from WBAI's Charles Ruas and Karen Achenbach as they talk with Albert Maisels and Ellen Hovday about Grey Gardens. And the special discovery for me is that we actually get to hear from the Beals themselves from an audio recorded at WBAI Studios. We hear Little Edie give a phone call into Big Edie.
Like, we got to know them
having been filming them with Lee Radziwill. It started, uh-huh. The whole project started out originally to be a film about Lee and possibly her sister, if she could get her sister to come into the film, in the old days when they lived in East Hampton.
The original project was based on that notebook published by Jacqueline and Lee.
Well, I think the notebook came out sometime later.
Because the film
was never made. But originally, we got a call one day from Lee asking us if we would come over to her Fifth Avenue apartment and talk with her about a film that she wanted to do about her childhood in East Hampton. So we sort of looked at one another and thought, my goodness, what has that got to do with us? Because those days are long gone by. We film only things that are right immediately in the present. So she said, well, it sounds kind of strange, but come on over and I'll show you a vague outline that I have. And that's what it was called at the top. And item number 33, I think it was the Beals. The other items were a golf caddy who used to work for her father, Black Jack Bouvier, and who was still around and who was a sheriff in Sag Harbor in these days. And it was to be kind of the memoirs of the two sisters. We thought we'd be experimental enough to go along with it and see whether there was a film. We began filming. Suddenly we struck gold when we met the Beals.
Oh, right.
And that was our great gold mine.
I'm not clear about the project that Lee and Jacqueline had in mind. Was it simply a documentation of people who participated in their youth in the Hamptons?
Well, I think the vision that she had was close to what the book resulted as.
A sentimental retrospective.
Yes, and it wasn't.
Didn't you say
it wasn't
that it was maybe not a home movie, but a movie about home, which she hoped to have made very skillfully, but it was about her past and her childhood. And I don't think she was that clear, was she?
It was to be about home, but it wasn't really to get into home, that is, in any private way, in any real, with any great revelation of her feelings today, or her anxieties, or...
No, it was more nostalgia.
Right, more nostalgia than true penetration of relationships, meanings, feelings, sentiments, attitudes, and so forth. But all of that stuff, you see, which is the stuff of life, is what the Beals were more than open to reveal. After all,
to revealing,
they've always been that way, and they've just kept it at home. For 20 years or so, nobody entered Grey Gardens.
I see. What was the relationship in the original project of the Beal to the Radziwill film?
I'm quite sure that both Jackie and Lee, when they were children, must have thought of the Beals with a great, great twinkle in their eye. And more than that for Jackie, actually, because when Jackie was in her early teens, Edie Beal, the daughter, was the big, popular, beautiful, body-beautiful Beal of the Maidstone Club, the one that Jackie joined later on.
Yes.
And so that she always hoped that sometime she would be able to aspire to Edie's position. In fact, Edie says that she was engaged, or at least she had dates with the first Joe Kennedy, son.
John,
had he not been killed in
the war
mm-hmm. had the greatest promise of being one of our best presidents. So she could actually have ended up in the White House before Jackie.
Well, the resemblance is even more startling in your film when you show the adolescent photos of Edie. She's as stunning as Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. That she certainly was extraordinarily beautiful and resembled her cousin. Yeah.
But in many ways, their beauty remains strong and their character persists, and they're very prevailing people.
So, Albert, how did you meet them, and what was your immediate reaction on seeing them, other than, of course, the sort of sympathy one feels?
Well, when we walked upstairs...
In this dilapidated house?
In this dilapidated house.
Neglected house.
I remember before I even reached the room where all the filming was to take place and where the two of them spend almost all their time, just one room in over 20 rooms, as I came to the door, it was almost as though there were a wind of hurricane force of 180 miles an hour was blowing against me, and it was the smell of the cats. Another thing that happened, too, especially at the time when we came back to film them on our own, My mother had just died of cancer, and I was scared out of my wits about all things having to do with death. And because that was a kind of disease that when it strikes somebody in your own family, you don't know where it comes from, and no one has found a cure for it. So when I came back to that house, which most people think of as kind of haunted, I was convinced that it was haunted. And then I remember some kids going by in a car, sticking their heads out and shouting, "Those witches, those witches." And I had to overcome all that kind of prejudice myself. Of course, when later on, when other people drove by in cars, and they'd stick their, a woman, I remember, stuck her head out the window and called me over, and she quietly said, "I hope you're taking good care of them." There was always that kind of support, too.
But how did you eventually negotiate doing a film at Grey Gardens with the Beals?
Negotiate in what sense?
In the sense of they understood that they were going to be part of another film.
Oh.
That is a film about Lee Radziwill. And then suddenly you decided that they should be the subject of your project.
Well, Ellen knows the story so well, too, about Julie Christie.
Oh, yes. Well,
Julie Christie, another figure enters.
Well, Edie sat on the porch one day and told a story about a film company having come and said that they wanted to make a film about her and her mother, and they wanted Julie Christie to play her. and she said, "You know, not on your life. If anybody's going to play me, it's going to be me." And that was her feeling. She didn't want anyone to imitate her.
So in that sense, there was no necessity for negotiating the switchover from a film about Lee to a film about them.
They were
really now excited because it was about them themselves.
Yeah, and I think they had some sense that that they had been invaded by the public when their house was turned upside down and inside out, and they felt raped, if you will, you know, and they felt really
violated.
Yes, they did, and it was terribly traumatic for Edie, especially. Her mother is much more pragmatic. The Suffolk County Board of Health came and, as Edie says, raided the house and said that they would be evicted if the house was not cleaned up and renovated at once, that it was a health hazard. And you know, I suppose it was done with goodwill by the community. Nobody knows how it happened, or no one admits to it. But in fact, it happened.
And then it was a raid. There was no warning.
There was no warrant in the beginning, and then they had to go away and get a warrant, which they did, and they came back. And then when it became public knowledge, Jackie and Lee put up money and helped them do what was necessary in order to stay in the house. Well, anyway, that experience was really a very serious one for young Edie. And I think one of the reasons she wanted to do the film was to say, you know, if you want to know who I am, I'll tell you who I am, but don't come and treat me like an object. You know,
they
don't
were thoroughly
come invade
humiliated.
Me like that. Thoroughly humiliated and hurt and felt misunderstood and wanted to set the record straight.
Well, one of the things was that, at least in one of the raids, police came in with knives and razors and tore up all the upholstered furniture looking for dope. I mean, that's, you know, if you knew the Beals,
it's a
crazy presumption.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, but of course they didn't find any.
Now,
it's one of those things where people think that they're doing something for your good, you know.
Now, the house we see in the picture is supposedly renovated.
Oh, well, I mean, even as you see it now,
running water was put in.
Oh, yeah, right. I mean,
heating?
Some of the basic things were improved.
Well, they put in a new furnace, didn't
any
they?
Any painting?
New furnace.
Did some painting.
Some painting, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But if you see
off
it,
a lot
yeah,
of
if you see it now, the basic things are the furnace, the heating, which has never really been perfectly restored. It's fallen back again quite a bit to the way it was. I mean, the Beals are going to be what they are, and there's no changing their way of life. Of course, the whole thing is really subject to a great deal of interpretation. I mean, some people look at the house and regard it as a sore thumb, on the community because it looks entirely different from any other house in that area.
And yet it's hidden behind a lot of bush.
Yeah, but so you just drive by there, and you've got to slow that car down. It looks so different from every other house. And others look at it as a great monument to individuality.
Yeah.
And in a community like that, you pay a high price.
No.
But they're different in lots of ways. You know, there are very few women in this country who, as beautiful, especially as Edie was, as popular as she, would decide or be forced by the power of her own emotions to live out her life with her mother. She's 60 years old. She's never, except on several occasions for several years in New York, where she sort of tested out her ability to stay away from home, she's never really left home. Now she's 60 and her mother is 80. You know, is that appropriate behavior? What is it? I remember when I used to go home to Boston, and I used to visit my mother in her 70s then, and we'd walk along the street arm in arm. People look at me, my God, this guy must be a homosexual. What's wrong with him? I mean, what I'm saying is that the tolerance for individuality and for sentiments that we regard as being proper in a way, you know, but don't want to see put down, you know, that tolerance is very small in this country.
But Edie, did you feel that the way the film was edited showed that Ellen understood you and your mother?
I thought it was absolutely perfect. I was amazed because I had planned to write a book on my life, and I knew just how I wanted it to be, and I said, I don't think I ever will be able to do it, and then I said, well, at 90, I will be able to do it, and they did it.
Yes, they did do it. But, for example, when we see certain inserts of the cat, the raccoon, the moon, and so on, did you feel that they really, those pictures said what you wanted them to say?
Oh, yes. Completely. They were concise.
And so you liked the pacing of the film?
Yes, it had a rhythm. It was very orderly. Well, it had the Maisel style, because I went to see Gimme Shelter, and that had a certain style. It's an American style. It's, what can I say? It's not untidy. It's spare. And it's very beautiful. And it's not unlike a French classic.
Because it's so well structured.
Correct.
You open the film with the most beautiful line. You look at the shrubbery going over the ocean, and you say it's like the sea. If you drop anything in it, you'll never find it again.
It drops to the bottom, right?
Yes,
it
the goes sea of the leaves.
So that, in a way, the film really does try, the camera tries to go around your world, this ocean. But what about making the film after the Board of Health came, and they were so awful, the police were so dreadful? Did that give you an impetus to wanting to make the film?
No, I felt completely brainwashed. And how I felt even worse after our relatives tried to help us, because so many things happened while the workers were in the house. The house was laid open, and so many people ran around in it, and so many things disappeared, and we had robberies at night, and doors were left open, and... Well, when the Maisels appeared, I don't understand how we had any desire to even put on lipstick and say, how do you do? But we were very fond of them.
I think that's what did it, no?
Well, I think part of it was... I think part of it was that everyone else was trying to make judgments for you, trying to change your way of life, where they were unsatisfied with what you were doing, that your style of life and all. And we didn't even know what it was exactly, but we wanted to discover it. We wanted to film it, and in a way that wouldn't change your way of life, wouldn't really intrude on it, but that would,
in fact, support it.
Support it, and just pay a lot of attention to it. Didn't you feel that? Did that make the difference?
I thought it was fascinating.
And that does it for this week's From the Vault. If you would like to join our campus campaign sponsoring school libraries across the country, visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org or call us in the archives toll-free at 1-800-735-0230. This program is written and produced by Mark Torres and Brian DeShazer. The series is executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and your host, Brian DeShazer. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and past grants from the American Archive, funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Internet Archive, Other Minds Archives, and partnerships with UC Berkeley Moffitt Library, the Internet Archive, Other Minds Archives, and our supporters are Pacifica members. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. Thanks for listening and keeping our film history alive.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
My name's Josh Tucker. I'm a freelance journalist based in Chile, and I've been working here for more than 4 years for organizations like Democracy Now!, Discovery Channel, Intercontinental Cry, and Unicorn. It's a real pleasure. I'm always happy to report.